This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Dr. Ronald D. Maurer. Today is 6 August 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Dr. Maurer is kindly joining me by telephone from his home in Mount Pleasant, Utah. Dr. Maurer, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background biographical information from you, if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Mount Pleasant, Utah. 84647.
And when were you born, sir?
I was born on the 25th day of December, 1928.
A Christmas baby, then. Very good, very good. Well, what were your parents' names?
I'm sorry?
What were your parents' names? Your mother and father.
I'm missing a word here.
I'm sorry. What were the names of your parents?
Oh, my parents. Okay, my parents. Excuse me, my father's name was Roland Grant Maurer, and my mother's name was Viola Elizabeth Hansen, with an E-N.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did they do for a living?
Oh, they were, we were in an agricultural area, and much of their life was spent doing things related to agriculture. However, my father did retire from a manufacturing plant where he started during World War II, and he worked there until he retired, and they manufactured explosives for the war and then after the war.
Interesting. Now, being born, of course, in 1928, this was right before the onset of the Great Depression. What do you remember about growing up during the Great Depression?
Oh, I can remember things. I can remember some of the situations. I remember living out in a rural community where we had dirt and rock roads, and some of those were the main roads. And I remember, in association with the Depression, was the Dust Bowl, I remember asking my parents about it because the air was kind of dusty at times. We were not in the center of the Dust Bowl, but we were on the side, and we got it every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we never talked about how poor we were. We didn't talk about that. My folks, when I look back at it, I say, good gracious, we were really poor. My father and my mother were given a house by his mother. My grandmother gave them a house and a cow when they got married. And we lived in a small community in a town, and his parents had a large farm not too far away. There were 13 kids in his family, and there were 13 children in my mother's family in Mount Pleasant. And everybody was in the same condition. You know, we were just, you got one pair of shoes a year, and you got a new pair of pants or something, or a shirt or a jacket every couple of years. And we seemed to get along fine. We played, we had fun. We were never bored in our life. I don't even remember the word bored, because we always had sticks and stones and leaves and feathers and all rocks and all kind of things like that, and our imaginations. And so we always had lots of things to do. We lived in a very scenic area. We didn't realize it was scenic then. It was just an interesting area where we had mountains around us, we had streams around us, we had lots of animals, deer, coyotes, and all sorts of small game. We had pheasants and ducks and things like that. So it was sort of like living in an awful nice place, except we were really poor in that nice place.
Mm-hmm. Did you have brothers or sisters?
I have three sisters who are younger.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is about 2 years younger than me. One of them about 4 years younger. And the other, I think she was about probably 7 years younger, 8 years younger, something like that.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things did you like to do when you were growing up? Being in this part of the world, did you hunt or fish or take part in things like that?
Now, say that again, please.
I'm sorry. Growing up in that part of the world, were you into hunting and fishing, things like that?
Oh, there was lots of... my father was a fisherman and a hunter, and he liked to go fishing every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we had lots of trout, and we had a lot of deer and things like that around us. So there was a lot of that kind of activity. It wasn't a sport. It was to live.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, obviously a defining moment or defining event during this time out of the Great Depression was the Second World War. What do you remember about the early days of World War II?
Well, actually, I was kind of knowledgeable as a kid. I was kind of knowledgeable. I remember the day the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Hmm. Tell me about that.
I was standing in a line to go to a movie theater, and we had a little theater in the town of Fairview. That's where I grew up, Fairview, Utah. And it's just nearby Mount Pleasant. And in the afternoon, they had a matinee. A matinee cost us a dime to go to. And usually it consisted of one or two main features with comedies and newsreels and all kinds of stuff like that, cartoons. And we were in that line, and one of the boys came up to me and said, "Hey, did you know the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?" And I said, "Oh, my goodness, that's awful. Where's Pearl Harbor?"
Hmm.
He says, "It's out in the ocean, Hawaii or someplace." Well, now, my folks, we didn't take a newspaper. We didn't have a telephone. We had a little air castle radio, and we could hear the news on the radio, our programs for kids and grown-ups. But we also had another thing, and that was Life magazine.
Mm-hmm.
The little drugstore nearby had a Life magazine. A new one every week came in. It was the large format, and after a while, I started having colored pictures in there, and they kept us informed about what was going on throughout the world. So I was aware of the war in Ethiopia. I knew about the war going on in Spain. I knew that the Balkans. I knew where the Balkans were, and that there was a war started in World War I there. I knew that the Italians had invaded Ethiopia, and I knew the Japanese had invaded China. And I didn't necessarily know where all those countries were, but there was a lot of information in pictures in that Life magazine.
Hmm,
and
yeah.
We often talked about it as kids.
That is very interesting. You were very much aware of what was going on then.
Better informed about things, than, I believe, than kids are today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, growing up during the war, was it ever your desire to get involved in the Second World War?
Yes. When the war started, I was about, I was in the seventh grade in high school, which means I was 12 or 13, something like that. Well, it was 1941, of course, and it was just shortly before my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a National Guard in the local area, and in the summer of 1941, our National Guard boys were mobilized by the federal government. They federalized, I guess, was the word.
Mm-hmm.
They were federalized, and they left on a train. And I remember going up, and we lived right near the tracks in these small towns. Everybody does. And we all waved at all these soldier boys, all these guard boys going off to war. And they weren't going to war. They were mobilizing for training so they'd be ready. And that was in the summer of 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And in that group, I had a number of cousins. The little town of Fairview, eventually, it had 1,000 or 1,200 people. And there were, I think, over 200 kids from Fairview served in World War II. Of that 200, there was about a dozen of them killed, and lots of people injured, and prisoners and missing and all that kind of stuff. So we had people killed very early in the war. In the Battle of the Coral Sea, I was our first Marine I'd ever heard of was from our town, was killed in that. So we knew about these things, and when these guys would come home, it was a big deal for everybody to go listen to their stories. And they were fascinating, the places they were going and what they were doing and the things they were seeing. And, of course, there was a lot of tragedy involved with those who were lost.
Sure. Now, with this kind of background, was this something that inspired you to join the services for the Second World War?
Yes, we had. I had several cousins who. It's interesting that in this inland state of Utah, in this particularly in the area where we lived, none of us knew anything about the ocean other than what we read in Life magazine, and. An awful lot of the kids joined the Navy rather than be drafted into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So we had lots and lots of guys in the Navy, so I wanted to be a sailor. And then there's a big long story about how I was in the 8th grade, the 9th grade. In those grades, awful lot of the boys were beginning to be drafted at 18, so we had fewer and fewer of those young or the late teens and the early 20s around. They were in the military. They come home. They impressed us. We heard about all the experiences they had. That impressed us. And then this Life magazine, we saw all these pictures of the wars all over the world, so we were pretty excited about it. And I was the youngest in the town that went in the service, I think, in World War II. And I joined the state militia, which was the State Guard, after the National Guard was nationalized and went off to war. Then another guard was formed under the state, and it was called the State Guard. And I joined that, and my as well as my father and one or two of my friends, at the age of 14, and oddly enough, we were trained to be strike breakers because we had coal mines nearby, and our government was afraid that John L. Lewis, who was the president of the miners in America, if they went on strike, they would deprive federal interests of energy, and we had a big steel plant being built about 50 miles away, and we had a big hospital up a little further. That was an important thing. We had a thing called Hill Field was being built for military, and we had a lot of government facilities around that needed and used a lot of energy, and the government didn't want those organizations to be deprived of energy to do what they had to do. So the State Guard was supposed to, if there was a strike, the guard would go in and keep the striking workers from impeding those who wanted to go there to work to keep the coal coming out of the mines.
That is very interesting to be that young to be trained for that kind of duty.
That age, yeah. I look at me when I was. I went in the service a couple of years later, at 16, and I look at that picture and I look. I should have been a Boy Scout at that age.
I should
have been wearing one of those little neckerchiefs and be working on the Life Scout badge or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe shortly just after I turned 16.
Interesting. Now, were you ever called into a for any sort of strike-breaking duty?
No, we were never. We were just trained.
Yes, yes. Now, the war continues on, and you get older. You mentioned you joined the Navy at age 16. Can you tell me how that happened?
No, say that, please.
I'm sorry. The war is continuing on here, 1944, 45, and you mentioned that you joined the Navy at age 16. How did that come about? How did that take place?
When I was 14, I joined the Coast or the Guard.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 15, I decided I ought to go on active duty, and some friends were trying to go in underage, so we tried to join the Coast Guard, and we enlisted, and eventually they found out my age when I went up to report to go on to boot camp, and they tossed me out. So that was at 15. When I turned 16, or just before I turned 16, I decided I'd like to be a Marine. So it's a humorous story about that. I was 16 years old. I went to a Marine Corps recruiting office, and right near the front door in that recruiting office was a desk, and it was manned by a lady Marine. They called them BAMS, B-A-M-S. That was the abbreviation for lady Marine. And when I walked in that recruiting office, she says, "Well, what can I do for you?" And I knew I looked awful young, and actually I didn't start shaving much until I was 19 and getting ready to get out of the Navy years later. But I looked her in the eye, and I thought, boy, I've got to impress her to make her think I'm older. And I took a deep breath, and in my deepest voice I said, "I want to be a Marine." And she looked at me and she says, "Oh, you get out of here." Just like my little baby brother. And so I got tossed out of the Marine office, recruiting office, and I felt really embarrassed. I wanted to be a Marine that week. And then about 3 months later, I thought, well, I'll try it again, but I'll try the Navy. And by golly, I was able to pull it off that time. And I went on active duty. I was on what they call a minority cruise, which keeps you until your day before you're 21. You finish your service. And by the way, the people who were drafted into the military, they were given variable enlistments. And those variable enlistments allowed them to sign up for 4 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, or until the war, 6 months after the war, when the war ended, then they could get out.
Right.
So if you were a young man and they drafted you, you were subject to military duty until the end of the war plus 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the war, everybody would get out very quickly. Well, me, I didn't. I was going to be in there for initially a four-year period, we thought, and that's what it ended up being. But I was a regular Navy. That was the difference between a regular and a reserve. So I joined the regular Navy. I went to boot camp. I was a terribly young-looking kid. I worked hard. I was kind of athletic, not very big, though. I got through boot camp okay. They tested us, and everybody was evaluated to see where they could be used best. They found that I didn't have enough training to build on. That I was later I found out that kids in my category were called a category four or something like that. That means you're untrainable. You're not smart enough to drive, so they would make truck drivers out of you, or let you clean toilets or something like that. But so there was jobs for you. So I went in, took a test, didn't do very well. They says, okay, you just have to go aboard ship, and then in the Navy they have a program. You strike for a rate. That's strike, S-T-R-I-K-E. In other words, you identify an organization on the ship that has a certain kind of responsibility. You ask to go into that organization. They accept you or not. If they don't, then you stay a deckhand, or we called you're a gopher.
Right.
And if you strike for something, then you get some books and you start studying in their particular specialty. whether it's in guns or cooking or corpsman or whatever, mm-hmm. you work towards that end, and that's just another way of getting advancement is by an awful lot of study. So I did that. That's what I did in the Navy. I was overseas during the war in the Japanese area, operating out of the Aleutian Islands. We were up there when the atomic bombs were detonated, operating up there. Not long after that, we were sent to Japan. We were part of the Northern American Fleet, which was going to invade northern Japan. That's not the main invasion, but we were up there to Japan has a bunch of islands, and we would have been working in the northern islands.
Mm-hmm.
We were in Japan. We actually were, our ship went into a Japanese naval base on northern Honshu Island, and we were with, you know, oddly enough, I understand there were three surrenders of Japan. And they were all on the same day, the same hour, but one was held in Tokyo. That's one we all hear about and know about.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was held in Hokkaido Bay, Omanato Bay in the northern end of Honshu Island. That was for all the northern Japanese Empire military forces. And then the Southern Japanese Empire, which was in Singapore, they had a separate surrender down there, I understand. I've never found this in writing, but that's what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there for the surrender. We were there for a few months. Occupation of Japan, got to meet the people and all those kind of things. Eventually, we became involved in, let's get all these Americans home. So our warship, I was on a cruiser. We stripped away all the guns and ammunition and all that kind of war stuff, and we started hauling troops from Asia and the islands in the Pacific back to the United States. In about 6 months, most of those people that had been on the war front, hey, they were home, getting ready to get out. They were out or getting ready to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around and said, oh my gosh, I want to go home. The war is over. And then we had a little problem. They says, you can't. You're a regular Navy. You've got a fixed enlistment till you're 21. And I said, yeah, but my mom needs me. They says, well, that's the way it is. And I said, well, what if I told you I was too young? They says, well, you can tell us that, and we'll check it out. So I said, okay, I'm going to write my folks. They said, yeah, that's the thing to do. Get them to request your release from the military because you're still less than 17 years old. You had to be 17 to be enlisted. And so I wrote my folks. And a couple of weeks later, I got a letter from my mother and dad. And they said, dear son, we're glad you're okay. We're glad the war is over. We're glad you've got something to do since you chose not to go to school. Maybe the Navy can teach you a trade or something. It's sure good that you were able to get in the Navy. And no, you wanted to be in the Navy so much, all the shenanigans you pulled trying to get in the service, we're not going to intercede in any way. You just go ahead. You signed up. You fill your obligation. So that came back to me, and I went back to the skipper on the ship and said, hey, my folks said they'd sure like for me to be able to stay in the Navy, and they said, okay, we'll just ignore the fact that you're too young, and you can stay in the Navy until that enlistment. We're going to have to change the date. That's going to extend your 4 years to 5 years, because we'll change the date of your birth. And I said, oh my gosh, I don't want to spend an extra year. And they said, okay, then let's just forget the whole thing and go on with what we've already got set up for you.
Right.
So I stayed in the Navy for the full, nearly 4 years.
Hmm.
And got out. I was still 19 years old, had almost 4 years in the Navy. I was shaving by that time regularly, and that ended my military career with the Navy after that period. In December 1948, I was released from the Navy.
That's fascinating stuff. I want to back up here a little bit, if I may, and let's go all the way back to basic training in the Navy. First of all, where did you go through basic training in the Navy?
I went through basic training at the Naval Training Center in San Diego, California.
In San Diego. Now, here you are, 16 years old. You're being thrown in with young men who are quite a bit older than you, perhaps more experienced than you. What was the basic...
They were also, at that time, they had upped the draft age. They started out drafting the 18 years, 19-year-olds, and 20-year-olds, and pretty soon they go through all those, and they're up the 25-year-olds. And toward the end of the war, they were drafting people that were almost 35 years old, who were married. So, you know, so they could get those 15 million people they needed in the military.
Right. Well, what was that like for you as such a young boy? What was it like for you to be thrown in with the rest of these guys and training to fight a war with the Navy? That must have been incredible.
Well, there was this huge cross-section of different people, and most of us were there because we wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that's where we should be. We thought we were helping our country, and we considered it really an honor to serve, and as long as they needed us for the war, we were glad to be there. An awful lot of them, as soon as that war was over, they said, let's lay down our guns and go home. We've had enough war. We go home and try to build a life for ourselves.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was awfully young even then when the war was over. And I didn't have any prospects for going to school or anything like that at that time. I'd only completed the ninth grade. I'd never gone to high school, and so I was one of those guys on that untrainable list. But you always need a few of those kind of people around.
Sure.
And you just learn to get the dirty jobs. Now I was pretty ambitious. I worked hard while I was in the Navy, and I was given some opportunities. And I didn't get many of those bad jobs, because as soon as the war was over, I was on a gun crew. They were no longer going to have guns, so I said, I need a specialty where I can advance in the Navy. So I became what they call a quartermaster in the Navy, which means nothing about supply or anything like that, which the Army and the Air Force, those people call quartermasters. The quartermaster in the Navy is involved in working with the officers, having to do with controlling the ship. The captain is the skipper, and the skipper tells us where we're going to go. There's officers that help him, and I was one of the enlisted people that helped him there. So I was on the bridge where the captain was, and had various tasks up there to go on and do. When we were in port, I was always on the quarter deck, and I had to keep logs and record a lot of things that was going on there. We become assistants to the navigator. We actually steered the ship. There's a steering wheel on the doggone battleship and cruisers I was on. And you go up there and you guide the ship. You're not commanding it. You're just following the orders of what to do next, which way to go. So I got in that. It was a very interesting field, because you're there among the officers and you kind of have an idea of what's going on around you. A lot of the people don't. They're in other parts of the ship, and they're counting supplies, or they're technicians, you know, electricians and carpenters and welders and pipe fitters and all that kind of stuff. They've got specialties. They run the big boilers on the ship. Well, they also have a deck crew. That's what I was associated with. They're the guys that does all the painting and the chipping and and scrubbing the decks and all that kind of stuff, keeping the ship painted and looking good and working well. So we, it was opportunity if you worked hard, and I tried to work hard, but I didn't have a very good base. So after 4 years, I was glad to get out and try to find some more opportunity.
Yeah. What ships did you serve on during the war?
Well, my first ship was the USS Pensacola, CA-24. It was the oldest heavy cruiser in the American fleet, and it had a sister ship of the same class, and it was the USS Salt Lake City, and it was the CA-25. And these two ships had an awful lot of action in World War II. They were old, they were expendable, they used them a lot, they were on duty when the war started, and they were famous old fighting ships. Now, after the war was over, then we had the atomic bomb tests, and I was involved in those. After the atomic bomb tests, I had a cruise to China on a new cruiser, and so we spent about 6 months in Asia, and fascinating being in China at that time, 1947. And then we came back to the States, got the ship all fixed up again, and next it was going to go to Europe, and since I had less than a year to go, they let me transfer off, and they put me on Harry Truman's yacht. Now, not his real yacht, which was the Williamsburg, but I was on the USS Missouri. The Missouri was BB-63, the battleship 63, and it was one of our newest battleships. And good heavens, I got to go to Europe and in the Caribbean and other places and that. And that was my last several months in the Navy. Now, when I was in China, I was on another cruiser. My second ship was the USS Columbus, named after the Ohio City, and it was called the CA-74. And it was a wonderful ship, and it was a nice newer cruiser, and that was good duty, and I enjoyed that, and we went to a lot of places and saw a lot of things. So I traveled a lot in the military, enjoyed it. I considered staying in, but I would never advance very far because I didn't have the education.
Right, right.
Or I was limited, let's say. My opportunities were less than if I'd had an education.
Sure. Tell me about your experiences during the war. What kind of action, if any, did you see aboard the Pensacola?
Now, let me just cough a minute here.
Sure.
And reposition this doggone hearing.
That's fine.
Piece on my telephone. Now, what was it about?
What kind of action did you see during the Second World War?
I apologize. I'm just not getting that sentence.
No, I'm sorry. It's my fault. What kind of action, if any, did you see while you were aboard the Pensacola during World War II?
In the Navy, I never saw any military action. I was I was in the war zone. I was on a ship that was going, doing things. But we were never in an action. We were never in an invasion, or we never intercepted any enemy fleets. We fired at stuff in the air, which, you can't see some of these airplanes that are up there. And so you fire in the air where they are. They're not supposed to be friends and stuff that. But that's as close as I come to real action.
Yeah.
But the when we landed in Japan at the surrender time was really interesting. But I'll talk about that otherwise if you want to.
No, please tell me. I think this is fascinating information here. Tell me about this.
Okay. I've got dates and all that stuff. I don't have it in front of me right now.
That's okay.
But we were in the Northern Pacific Task Force, and I've even got a communication here someplace. Oh, sitting, I've got piles of stuff here. I've got a copy of a communication. This comes from an admiral, and our admiral was Jack Fletcher. Vice Admiral Jack Fletcher was the head of our particular group, and our group was called, this is September the 8th, 1945, this message was sent, and in Navy terms, this guy was the commander of that Northern Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
We entered the Northern Honshu at noon on September the 8th. Now, there's a big bay on the northern end of the main island of Japan, and it's called the Bay of Omonato, and it was a huge Japanese Navy base. Well, our division, our group, a large number of our ships, went in there. We were among them. They had to lead us through the minefields that protected their country by a Japanese minesweeper, and they took us in, and we anchored in the anchorage of this Omonata Naval Base. And then, and among the ships there, of course, was the old Pensacola and the Salt Lake City and some other old cruisers and stuff, another class of cruisers and other supplies. Then there was a command ship. That's a special ship that usually has the big shot admiral on it and lots of communications. And that's where this guy was. Now, they held a peace treaty. Peace treaty was signed in Omonata Bay aboard this command ship. And it's got a funny spelling of his name. It's a Panamint, but I'm trying to find out. This thing is so old. This is a copy of this communication that was sent out to all the ships and the fleet up there. And he was, oh heavens, I'm not, it's so gone. I think, if I remember right, it was the AGC-11, but it was called the Panamint, P-A-N-A-M-I-T, or something like that. And I apologize. I have to get my better glasses out to read it.
No, that's okay.
Okay, anyway, the command ship there,
mm-hmm.
It was there. The Japanese officials went aboard the command ship. They signed a treaty up there, and at the same hour, they were signing the treaty in Tokyo, and at the same hour, they were signing the same surrender ceremony in Singapore. So there were three of them going on. We were in one of them in northern Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're in there, this is a fairly large bay, but we were a couple thousand yards, which is a half mile or less, from the beaches, and we could see the people walking around over there. We couldn't see any people armed, because all of a sudden, when we made arrangements for this peace treaty, the Japanese military just evaporated. It was gone.
Mm-hmm.
These millions of soldiers that Japan had available were suddenly gone. Their weapons were stacked. They left. They abandoned all their weapons, and they went home. And so we sit there and watch those people. A couple of days later, they sent us to an island further north, a great big island up there called, I'll think of it in a moment. Hokkaido.
Mm-hmm.
Hokkaido was the capital of that island. Hokkaido is the island, I should say. Hokkaido was the capital. And we looked at the people up there. Then we went around to the west side of that northern island. There's a couple of cities over that way, Otoro and Sapporo. And they says, okay, now you guys are going to be able to go ashore here. So we did go ashore at Omanato when we, after they signed the treaty. And, well, let me just tell you about that. That's quicker. At Omanato, they said, okay, you can go ashore, but you can't carry any weapons. You can go ashore, but you absolutely will not molest any Japanese people. You will not confiscate any of their materials. If you want a souvenir or something, you have to buy it at their prices. And you're welcome to go over and look around. So we went over, we got off our landing boats, walked up and down the streets, and we'd pass the Japanese, and they were dressed kind of funny, because they wore funny clothes, and the people wouldn't even look at us. We'd just walk by them, and then after we'd pass, they'd kind of look back to see what you were doing, you'd kind of look back to see what they were doing. After a while, somebody finally decided we could smile, so we smiled. And they occasionally would smile back. And then we would go in some of the stores and look around and try to talk to the people. We couldn't, but we let them know we were looking for souvenirs. And by golly, I bought a fishing reel from a dad and a couple of other things. And after a while, we got so we could actually not communicate very well with the people on the streets, but we could smile at them and indicate that we were friendly. They would do the same. Now, when we went to the next city up in northern Japan, the big one, we started, they told us they'd go ahead and they had an awful good beer up in northern Honshu, and or northern on Hokkaido Island. And I think the beer was called Sapporo, and they still make it today. And the boys would go in and start drinking beer. Then they would ask you, do you want some of this? They'd show you what they're trying to sell you in the bar. It would be a dried fish or a cheese. The dried fish looked awful, particularly with flies on it, and the cheese looked slimy. But you would drink one of these beers, and gosh, they had awfully good beer, really good beer. And you'd drink one less than a quart, and you're feeling awfully good. And somebody would say, hey, do you try that cheese yet? No. Have you tried it? No. Let's try some. After a while, we were eating that slimy cheese and brushing the flies off the dried fish, eating the fish, and we were just enjoying ourselves in Japan. I went back a couple of years later, and I saw some other very impressive things then. But that was initially where, this is right the day the Greece Treaty was signed and stuff like that. We were over on the in Japan. And the people had been, the war had come to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were working hard, trying to live and trying to survive and trying to get things reorganized and so on. And it was very interesting.
Yeah. Now, after the war, you're involved in helping move the service personnel back to the United States. You said that was about a six-month process. You were involved with that?
No, we were in northern Japan in September, and we left, I think, about in near the 1st of December, maybe late November, something like that.
Okay.
And went from there to Iwo Jima, where my ship had been hit pretty bad, but just before I went aboard it.
Mm.
And we brought back a bunch of Marines, and that was after the war was over, and brought them back to the United States. I've got stories about that. I got all these crazy stories that took place. We were leaving Iwo Jima with a load of Marines coming back to the United States. My job was to go through the ship every 15 degrees of longitude because we're changing the clocks to the local time
mm-hmm.
on the ship. My job was to wind and keep all the clocks on the ship operating properly. I wasn't a clockmaker, but I set the times and kept them wound. And I was going through at midnight, usually when we set our clocks, and I was going through and I got sick. I thought, oh my gosh, weather's kind of rough. And I've never been seasick before. I don't know why I'm sick. And I stopped by the sick bay and knocked on their doggone door, and some guy says, what do you want, Mac? And I says, well, I'm kind of sick. I've never been nauseated like this before. And they said, well, you're just seasick. Here, take these pills. Come back at sick call if you don't feel well. So I got a couple of capsules. And I'd never seen a capsule before. I've seen pills, but not capsules. It looked like it was made out of plastic with stuff inside. You could see through it. And so I went into a restroom. We called them heads in the Navy. And I looked at that and I said, how in the world do you take this? I guess I got to break this thing open and take that powder that's in there. So I broke this capsule. I really should have eaten the pill, eaten the capsule, but I didn't know that. So I broke the capsule, dumped the powder in my hand, and just sort of licked it up with my tongue. And then I went through the ship, and a little later on I got nauseated. I did get nauseated. I went up and down in the bottom of the ship, up the top of the ship, all over, got all the clocks set. The next morning I was really ill, and when they came around, I said, hey, can I stay in my bunk for a little while? I'm really sick. I can hardly get around here. I'm ill. They says, no, we've got a general drills, all kind of practice drills all morning, because we've got to teach these Marines that just came aboard what they do in emergencies. And you have to be in your station. And I said, but I can't do anything. They says, well, go down to sick bay now, because the drills are going to start in a few minutes. I went down to sick bay again. I said, hey, I'm sick. They said, sorry, we're going to have drills. You have to go to your stations, and when it's over, come back. I says, I can't get back up. We don't have stairways on ships. You have, looks like a ladder. You go up and down ladders. And I couldn't get back up out of sick bay there. So they started having drills. I just laid on the deck in front of the sick bay door, which is called a port in the Navy. They had all their drills for a couple of hours, and when they came back, I was laying there on the deck, and they tried to wake me up, and I wasn't feeling very good. I didn't know what was going on. They took me in the sick bay. In just a little while, they had me on the operating table, and I had my appendix out. They were about to burst.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So, after it was all over, our medical officer, who did the surgery, was helped by an enlisted man, and they did the surgery, and then the medical officer came over to me after I woke up, and he says, you know, that's pretty stupid of you not coming down to sick bay when you're sick. I says, I did. He says, you know, if you'd waited much longer, we would have thrown you out of the porthole, I mean, throw you over the side of the ship, you're dead,
right,
and kept your appendix. Instead, they threw the appendix over the side, and I got to stay.
Well, it worked out the way that it did.
I was sick all the way back to the United States. When we got to Pearl Harbor, we stopped there, and it takes a few days to go from Japan and the Orient to Hawaii. And they said, hey, you want to go up on deck and see what? Have you been to Pearl Harbor? I said, no. They said, well, you want to go up and see what that area looks like, Hawaii? And I said, yeah. So they put me in a wire basket and carried me up these stairs and let me lay up on the front of the ship called the forecastle. And I couldn't sit up. I had to lay in this basket and look over my shoulder, and I could see some palms in the distance, and that was my first trip to Hawaii. We got back to the United States, discharged our crew, by then I was getting up, so they kept you in the sick bay for a week or so before I was able to get up and get around. And I can make that into a big, long, hour-long story. But anyway, I got back, and they says, well, sorry, you're ready to go back on duty now. The ship's leaving tomorrow to go back to Guam, and you can go back for the ship. And so we did. We went back to Guam, picked up another load of Marines, and we were on Guam on Christmas Day. My birthday, they let us go ashore there. We drank a little beer and looked at the war had been over there for about 6 months. We got to see where all the invasion had taken place and all that kind of stuff. The most interesting thing about Guam, I guess, was the fact that the Red Cross was already there and they had a USO. And so we walked over to this USO, which was right on the beach, and we got, they gave us a Christmas gift, a little package with chewing gum and tobacco and a couple of things, deck of cards in it. And then they gave us coffee and donuts. Now, I shouldn't say gave it, that's the term they use, but I got free coffee and donuts for a quarter. So, anyway, the Red Cross was there to meet us, and they were nice. Then I came back to the United States, and that was the end of those kind of things. And then we go on to other ships and such things.
Now, you also spent time in China, you said.
I'm sorry?
You also spent time in China, correct?
Oh, my. I'm not making that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me change this on my end just a little bit. Can you hear me now?
Your voice is kind of breaking there on my.
I'm sorry, Dr. Maurer. Let me work on my equipment on this end, and I'll call you back in about 10 minutes. Would that be okay?
Well, you betcha. I'll be just sitting here trying to figure. You betcha.
Okay, sounds good.
I'll be here.
All right.
Okay. After World War II, we did have a bunch of atomic bomb tests. We had two atomic bomb tests at Bikini. I was there for those. And then when we came back from Bikini, the next year, 1947, our ship, and I was on the USS Columbus at that time, was told that we were going to go to China on a Asian tour, or Asian assignment. And it included China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on this new ship, or not a new ship, but with a new crew on. And we prepared for, and we went to China, and it was a fascinating thing. We were gone for about 6 months, and our initial station was in Shanghai. Now, I didn't know much about China, but Shanghai is not on the Yangtze River. It looks like it is when you look on a map. But Shanghai is not. The Yangtze is a huge, long river, major river in China, one of them. But you go into the Yangtze estuary and go up this Yangtze a short distance, and you come to a small river. This small river goes over and serves Shanghai and some places above it. Shanghai was a huge city, and I can't remember how large it was at the time, but I think I've heard the term 5 million or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 1947. The communists were on the offensive throughout much of China, and they were not too far from Shanghai, but they hadn't taken Shanghai. There were lots and lots of people that were fleeing from the communists. And these weren't just Chinese. These were, Shanghai was famous for its huge Russian colony. And later on, some of us sailors found that, and we used to like to go to the Russian clubs because they had American music and orchestras and a lot of good vodka and things like that there. So we liked the Russian clubs there. But Shanghai was a was the streets were filled with people living in the streets because of all these people that were fleeing from the communists into Shanghai. It was still under control of the nationalist forces. The skipper of my ship had been the Navy commander of China during World War II.
Hmm.
He had spent, a dozen or more years in China, in that area. He was a specialist in China. Many of his assignments related to China. His name was Admiral, when he first went to China, he was a captain. It was Captain Milton E. Miles. Later on, he became commander of the U.S. forces in China for the building up of the Chinese army, which would fight against Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a big political deal going on at the time. And like so many times, we have things going on that are just ridiculous. But at that time, the Army and the Navy were at war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We were at war with the Japanese, but the Army and Navy were against each other, almost. And the Army wanted control of China and all the Chinese military that were against the Japanese. And this Navy guy, this Navy captain, was given this assignment by the American forces in Washington. And so the Army was working out of Burma and other countries in that area. And I'm trying to think which one especially, but Burma was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Army had control of essentially all of the military flights that were going from India. India was the one I was trying to think of. We would send supplies to India. They would truck them over on the Burma Road or fly them over the hump
mm-hmm.
into China, and we're building up military there. But since the Army was flying all the supplies in, they wanted to send them to Army bases, and they wanted to have Chinese Army people assigned to them. And so we had this fight between the Army and the Navy about who's in command. And this Admiral Miles then was caught in this thing, and he was a pretty competent guy. You'll find, if I talk very long, that I really admired him. Tremendous guy. But he was there. They were fighting against the Japanese in various places. And our Army and the Army Air Forces were all under the Army, which was out of Burma and India. And so this was an awful mess over there. Well, this Admiral Miles, just before the war was over, they transferred him back to the United States. General Marshall, who was one of our top military people in Washington, came up with a great idea. When Japan surrendered at the end of the war, I understand that General Marshall made arrangements with the Mao Zedong, who was head of China, and Chou Enlai, I think, was the other guy, that they would, the Japanese would surrender all their weapons to the communists. And General Chiang Kai-shek, who was head of the Chinese forces, which were allied with the American forces, would not get those weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's just completely contrary to any common sense, but that's one of the reasons, I guess, that we had such a mess right after the war with the communists were able to do much better than the nationalists, because the communists got the weapons from mm-hmm. the Japanese. So this Admiral Miles was the commander of the Navy during the war. Just before the end of the war, they sent him back to the United States. They let the Army have the run of things over there. And I guess Miles kind of came back, and the Navy lost face, and a bunch of things like that took place. after the war, 2 years after now, this same captain, now this Navy admiral, he'd been promoted to admiral. Then when the war was over, they made him a captain again. That was his permanent rank.
Mm-hmm.
So he became captain of the ship that I was on, and we went back to China for this 6 months tour. And he was really at home in China. He spoke Chinese. He had spent all these years in China. He knew the Chinese people. He knew all these people that were involved. You know, he had family members on the communist side and on the nationalist side, and they were cousins. And through all that mess over there, this Admiral Miles was familiar with all this stuff. And he talked to our crew about how he liked the Chinese people and how he thought we ought to treat the Chinese. Never treat the Chinese bad.
Mm-hmm.
So as sailors, we were impressed with this because we sort of go to a foreign port. That foreign port wants our money. Guys, do what you have to do, but go easy on us. We want your money.
Right.
And that's Panama, and that's wherever you go in the world, where the Navy goes a lot. But Admiral Miles was a great guy, and we were there with him for those 6 months.
Hmm.
So I was there in China. We had we were able to run around Shanghai and visit a lot of things and see things and do things. The United States military had taken over a great big racetrack in the middle of Shanghai and made that our military recreation center. While we were there, that was being run by the U.S. military for our recreation. Golf courses, soccer fields, tennis courts, bowling alleys, and all that kind of stuff was taken over by the U.S. military for the advantage of sailors like myself.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over there. China was a fascinating place to be and see and do and wander around and look at all the things going on there.
Yeah, I bet.
Captain had a great influence on his crew, and we respected him a lot. He later on became an admiral again and was an admiral in Europe doing things over there after he left that ship. Anyway, that was the Chinese thing in short.
I wonder if you might also tell me about another incredibly interesting piece of history in which you're involved here, and that is the Bikini Island atomic test. Can you tell me about that? How did that take place and that you were involved?
No, say that again for me, please.
The atomic test on Bikini.
Oh,
can you tell me about this?
Okay, the atomic bomb test was after the war was over. The United States had dropped a couple of atomic bombs in Japan, and they had exploded one prior to that in New Mexico. And that was a test day thing. Then when we dropped our two bombs, that just about was our arsenal, but the Japanese surrendered. And so after the war, we're demobilizing. We've got this huge military investment, and we haven't settled things with Russia yet. They're our ally, supposedly. We hadn't conquered, well, we had defeated Japan, and we had defeated Germany and Italy and those that were associated with them, but we wanted to demobilize. We wanted to not just throw all this military equipment away or give it to our enemies, so they decided we need to determine how effectively these atomic bombs can be used against a modern military like we had at the end of the war. So we took many of our ships. We had 75 target ships were identified and sent to Bikini, and I've forgotten the number of thousands of people that were sent over there to support this huge test thing. Initially it was set up as three different tests. There would be an air blast, there would be a slightly underground water blast, and then there was going to be a third test, and it was going to be in the summer of 1946. So after we came back from carrying troops. We took our ship into Long Beach, where we normally were, and they sent us soon thereafter to the San Francisco area, where our ship was stripped and made ready to become a target ship for that test. It was one of many.
Mm-hmm.
And then we left, went to Bikini. We were put in a target area where they stationed these 75 ships in this big bay area in this atoll, Bikini. And in July, the first test, they dropped an atomic bomb from an airplane. It went off about 500 feet above the water in the target area. We were probably, 12, 15 miles away. We were not allowed to watch it because of the brilliant flash and radiation from that.
Mm-hmm.
So the bomb went off. It did a lot of damage to some ships. The USS Nevada was an American battleship. It was the center of the target area. My ship was not very far from Nevada. And there were other big ships there. There were German ships that we'd taken, captured. There were Japanese ships that we had captured and took there and tested them on them too. After a few days, they found that some of those ships, people could go back on them. And so part of our crew from the Pensacola, we went back and lived on the Pensacola.
Is that right?
Yeah, we went back and stayed on the doggone thing. Now, there was no cooking or anything there like that, but we stayed on the Pensacola for a period of time.
Huh.
While the whole fleet was getting ready for the second test. And then they were evaluating what happened on the first test during this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
The second test, they positioned an atomic bomb, I think it was 90 feet under the surface in the lagoon where those ships were near the center, and it was detonated, and we got to watch it, and I think we were about 12 miles on that one, and we saw this huge shaft of water come up out of where those ships were, and you could see ships actually in that huge tower of water, and it sunk a bunch of ships. It radiated the water real bad, and after a while, some people went back on the ships. Now, we didn't go back to live on it, and I think I went, I can't even remember whether I went back on the ship now. I have to go back and read my things I wrote about it years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we were there for that, and then they got so much information, and they decided, hey, we don't even need a third blast. We'll be years analyzing all the data we've got.
Yeah.
So all of us were exposed to some radiation, and they were very careful to try to avoid anyone being over radiated. When they had some pretty good ideas how much radiation a person could take and what the results would be if you got over exposed. And we wore what they called a dose meter that recorded the amount of radiation that you had received.
Mm-hmm.
While that dose meter was around your neck.
Yeah.
So we went through that kind of a thing. We eventually came back in August, I believe, of 1947, and August of 1946, and then when we got back to the States, why I was transferred to a new cruiser in Long Beach, Terminal Island, California.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on a new ship, and then that new ship is the one that went to China. So that was 1946 for the atomic bomb test.
Hmm.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of us are still probably affected some way by that. I've been lucky. A lot of people died.
Hmm.
But they didn't die. There was not many. Well, I shouldn't even talk about it because I don't know. All that stuff is released. I'm involved in a million-man group that's being checked. to determine how that radiation affected this whole group of people.
Now, have you had any sort of negative effects from this?
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Have you had any negative effects from the radiation to which you were exposed?
Well, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What is your... I was also exposed to that Agent Orange in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we can get to that later, too, when we get to Vietnam.
There.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not long after they came back, but somehow or other, I didn't get exposed to the same amount they did, and so I don't think it's bothered me. But on the other hand, I have some physical things, which, like this hearing thing, we're not sure whether this is from flying jets or bombers or...
Right.
Or whether it's some way affected by atomic energy or radiation or orange or whatever it was.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, when you're finished with your time there in China, you come back to the United States. What's the next step in your career?
Okay, well, we came back to the United States. We went to Seattle, Washington, spent the winter there in dry dock. We were informed that our ship would be going to Europe, Mediterranean duty, and it had to be... You have to overhaul these doggone ships every once in a while, and it has to be brought up to standards. And so then we, after the winter in Seattle, we went to Panama, into the Caribbean, operated down there for a while. Then we went into Norfolk, Virginia. I was transferred from the Columbus to the battleship Missouri in Norfolk, Virginia, because I only had about 7 months or so to go, six or seven more months to go in the Navy. And so I was on the Missouri. She was the prize of Harry Truman, who is from Missouri, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he came aboard the ship, and everybody liked him. He was quite a guy. Even an old conservative like me, he was one of the best presidents we ever had. He didn't put up with a lot of nonsense that other people gave us.
Mm-hmm.
But he played cards and was rather outspoken on a lot of things. But anyway, we were on the Missouri. We went as far north as along the east coast of North America, up between Greenland and Canada. Oh, Davis Strait is up there.
Mm-hmm.
We were up there one day, and we measured the temperature of the water. I think it was 29 degrees or something like that. Then they turned this battleship around and made a high-speed run for the Caribbean. And a few days later, we got down in the Caribbean. The temperature was up close to 80 in the water.
Hmm.
So it was, you know, go from one contrast to the other. It was rather interesting. Then we went back into the Norfolk, went back to Annapolis, picked up a load of Navy Academy plebes, well, not plebes, that's the first year. Anyway, they're cadets.
Mm-hmm.
And we took them for their summer cruise to the Mediterranean, and where we went, we visited Portugal, and we visited North Africa and southern France. And from there, we went back to the Caribbean. Now, all these little funny things that happen to a person when you're traveling like that. About midpoint in the Atlantic Ocean, the captain of the Missouri said, okay, avast all, just stop the ship here. Stop the ship right here.
Mm-hmm.
And he sounded swimming call, and there's a bugle, there's a bugle thing they play when his swimming call is on in the Navy. So that meant that we stopped in the middle of the Atlantic, and that we all had to go down and find our swimming suits, and we could go up and go swimming. It was a beautiful day. The water was just like a mirror, and we did. We went swimming in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Now, it's always fun to add a little bit. Sometimes it's not exactly the way it happened. I was standing up on the side of this ship, and they says, oh, could jump. And I said, ooh, it's a long way down there to the water. Oh, go feet first. Make sure you don't jump on somebody that's already in the water. So I finally decided, well, I'd jump. So I jumped, and I went down. I don't know how deep you go, but you go down a few feet below the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came up, I, of course, was splashing around there, getting my head up so I could get to breathe and trying to get the water out of my eyes so I could see. And right there in front of me was a Lincoln log. Now, a Lincoln log, in Navy terms like that, you have to dispose of your waste on those warships. And they don't carry around big septic tanks and then go back to the land someday and dump them someplace. In the Navy, you just dump it in the water. And you don't save it. Unless you're in a port, and then you have to save it for a while, and then when you go out of the port, you dump it in the ocean. Our great cesspools, the oceans. So when I came up, there was this Lincoln log. Feces.
Uh-huh.
Right in front of my face.
Wow.
That was my experience in the middle of the ocean.
Well, certainly very memorable, if not particularly positive, I guess.
Okay, then we went back to the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
and we're down in the Virgin Islands and swimming and stuff. And there we had sharks around us when we were swimming off ship. But and they have these gunnery ranges around the world. You go over and you come to one of these areas and you sit and shoot into an abandoned island someplace. And run through some of your military exercises. So back to the States again. I was in the States in midsummer on
mm-hmm.
one of those trips, and I decided to take a leave to visit a cousin of mine. Now, he and I grew up together in Fairview, Utah, and we went in the Navy about a week apart. We went to boot camp at the same time, just about. We weren't in the same group, but we were just a few days apart there. We both were assigned to cruisers, our first ship. He went to the East Coast, and I went to the West Coast. He served his minority cruise as well, but he was older, so he got out before I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Florida then, and he met a girl. And they got married. And so in the summer of 1948, I decided, well, I'm going to go down and visit this cousin of mine down in Florida. I hadn't been to Florida yet. So I took a week off or 10 days and took a bus and went down to Florida. They says, his wife was a telephone operator. And she says, you come down here and visit us. I'll have you a different date every night. She was a telephone instructor
mm-hmm.
For the women. And so I went down there. By golly, make it short, they introduced me to a girl, and we spent almost every evening together. And by the end of this vacation, we had made plans that when I got out of the Navy in December, if we still felt so inclined, I'd go back down there and we'd get married. And boy, this is fast. But anyway, I did. I got out of the Navy in December 1948. Immediately went down to Florida. About 3 days later, my wife, this young lady, and I went to Georgia, got married, met her family, and all that kind of stuff. And I went to work in Florida and worked in a paper mill down there. But one of the first things she asked me, she says, how are you going to support me? I mean, how are we going to live?
Mm-hmm.
Here you're out of the Navy, you get a little money when you get out. I'd been saving my money all the time I was in the Navy. I said, well, I got a few bucks. And she says, yeah, but how are you going to make enough money for us to live and have a family? And I said, well, oh, gosh, we can go back to Utah and I can be a farmer.
Hmm.
And she says, well, I grew up on as a sharecropper's daughter in Georgia, and the joke is, her brother was killed in World War II, and so her father needed help on the sharecropping, so her brother had been the one that did all the plowing for the cotton and all the stuff they raised down south, but he joined the army and was killed. So when he died, Dad says, what are we going to do now? And he was beginning to get crippled from sugar diabetes. And, and she says, well, Dad, I can plow. And so she started plowing. And the joke is, she used a mule's ass for a compass until she was 18 years old. Well, so it meant she worked on the farm.
Right.
She did a lot of plowing and working there. When she finally got to be 18, she told her dad, I'm going to go get a job down in Florida and become a telephone operator. And so she did.
Hmm.
That's how I met her, is through this cousin's wife who introduced us. And we've been married for just 64 years now.
No, that's outstanding.
64 years. Hmm. My gosh. And my wife is my age.
We're
about the same age.
That's incredible. Well, Dr. Maurer, why don't we stop there for today, and we can pick this up at another time. Sure. This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Dr. Roland Maurer. Today is 14 August 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Dr. Maurer is kind enough to join me by telephone again from his home in Mount Pleasant, Utah. Dr. Maurer, when we left off last time, you had just separated from the Navy and were recently married. If you would pick up the narrative at that point, what happens next in your life, in your career?
Okay, well, as soon as I was discharged from the Navy, which was about the 17th, I think, of December 1948, the next day I was on a bus on my way to Florida, and I got down there the next day. And met the young lady I was engaged to, and we reconfirmed that we planned to get married, and as soon as we could. And so we had some friends down there said, well, look, the easiest way to get married down here is you just drive from Jacksonville, Florida, up to Folkestone, Georgia, and because they have a guy that's got a little booth there on the road, and you just drive up to that booth, and by golly, he'll marry you in about 10 minutes, and he charges you quite a bit, though. It was a high price. It was $10 to get married, so we were married. We went back to Florida. We had, in a day or two, preparing for this, we had rented an apartment that belonged to the mayor of Jacksonville. So we were living in one of his apartments. So we had an apartment. That's where we stayed for our honeymoon. And my wife was working still. She continued to work. And I started looking for work. And that's the way things started out. On the 23rd of December, we were married.
And what is your wife's name?
Her name was, well, she has a long name. Her first name was Nona. Her second name was Iva. Her third name was Lee. And her surname was Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So she had the four names, and then we added Maurer to that, so we're all set up.
Right. Well, what kind of work did you find?
Well, it took me about a month to get a job. I went to work at a paper mill. And you know, I've forgotten the name of the paper mill, but it was located on the outskirts of Jacksonville. I didn't know what a paper mill was, but in order to get a job down there, you just about needed to know somebody. Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out that we knew somebody that worked at that mill. He says, oh, I can get you a job. So he went over and talked to him. Next day I got a call and says, hey, you're hired, report for duty. And so I started working rotating shifts in a paper mill, and it's actually a paper mill, and there's two parts to it. There's a pulp mill, that's where they grind up the trees and make the pulp that they make the paper out of later. And then the board mill, that's where they actually make the paper, and I worked in the board mill.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that was a real experience, and it terrified the dickens out of me.
Why is that?
It was, first of all, the place smelled terrible. If you've ever driven through the South and gone by a paper mill, maybe 30 miles from it, all of a sudden there's this terrible stench, and you went, what in the world is that awful smell? Well, that's the paper mill. That's actually the pulp mill where it stinks so bad, but they're right next door to each other. But it overwhelms your senses to the point where after a while you don't even notice it.
Hmm.
But it was a terrible smell. My job was, I was the gopher on about a seven-man crew or something like that. And we ran the mill, and that included taking the pulp from the pulp plant, running it over to the board mill, running it through all of the big machines that eventually rolls it out, and we were making paper the width of a sheet of paper. Oh my gosh, it seems to me like it was about 12 feet across this thing. It run continuously, and it came off the end. They take this pulp, spray it on a big belt, and the water that's in the pulp starts to drain out of it. And then the pulp begins to it sort of begins to adhere to itself.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes matted, and as it goes through, eventually it enters a bunch of huge rollers, great big rollers that are sometimes three high, and it goes through these rollers, squeezing out the water, and heating it, and forming it into paper. After it's gone through several of these stacks of rollers, it comes out of the end awful fast, and so they have to have a way to have that machine running continually. And that's where the crew of men are standing down there, and they're running the darn thing. Now, about the first thing I noticed, all the men on my crew were missing fingers. We're missing all our fingers. And the reason for that is they got their fingers caught in these huge rollers. I don't know, they were maybe 4 foot in diameter, and it's 15 feet long or something like that. And you get your finger caught in there, and it just yanked off everything up to it until it came to a big thick bone, usually the end of the hand. Usually, before where the fingers fit onto the hand,
mm-hmm.
and pull all the fingers off up to there, and usually take the thumb with it. And I didn't like that. They told me, they said, hey, when there's a problem and you have to go between those big stacks of rollers and you're moving paper trying to get it either into the basement because you've got a break in the continuous flow, and you have to restart it again, or when you're in there checking things, never put your hands up very close to those rollers, because those rollers get a finger and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it scared the dickens out of me. There was a lot of static electricity in there, and it was awfully hot. Those rollers were steam heated, and so you're sort of baking the paper as it goes through these rollers. And every once in a while, these big, long streams of paper would break, and they wouldn't even shut the machine down. It just kept pushing all that material, trying to put it through the rollers. And if the rollers broke, then you had to push it into the basement under you. And in the meantime, you had to start anew the roller again. You had to get a start and get it through the roller and then thread it through all those doggone rollers again. So it was pretty terrifying.
Yeah, I would bet. So how long did you have this job?
One time, after I'd been there a few days. And we just got out of one of those things, and he says, "You look like you're scared to death." And I says, "I am. I am scared." And he says, "That's good. You won't get hurt if you're scared." Once you start going in there thinking you know what you're doing and you can master the thing, why, then that's when you take a couple of chances and there we go, then you have an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So he made me feel real good. I was the guy with the fingers. The newest guy on the crew.
Right. How long did you?
About 3 months.
3 months. And
yep.
Did you leave this?
3 months. And we rotated shifts, so we would work about 7 days, then we'd have a day or two off, and then we'd work change shifts and work another shift, work a week, and then we'd change shifts again. Then we would have maybe 3 days off in a row, and then we'd start with the third or fourth or what. There were three shifts,
mm-hmm.
and you just switch from shift to shift at the end of each week.
Right.
And that's not my idea of how I want to spend my life, working on one of those things. So my wife said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I says, "Well, you know, I don't like this. Let's go back to Utah and farm." And she says, "Well, I don't want to farm. That's where I grew up, was a sharecropper's daughter in southern Georgia. And I don't want really to be a farmer's wife."
Mm-hmm.
That's hard work. And
sure.
They'd gone through the Depression and everything like the rest of us in the country. And, I didn't realize we were all so poor, but we were poor. We didn't have a car. I had to ride the bus wherever we went. You know, you don't have much in the way of clothes. We were poor.
Mm-hmm.
With both of us working. And we began to save our money to do for whatever we were going to do. She suggested, "What will you do?" And I said, "Well, we can go to Utah and farm." She says, "I don't want to farm." I said, "Well, my dad's got a farm out there. We can work on that." Well, she didn't want to do that. "Why don't you go to school?" And I says, "Well, you know, I dropped out of school, really. I only finished about the ninth grade, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not too good of a student." And she says, "Well, you ought to be able to find something you could do. What did you do in the Navy?" Well, I reviewed that. I used to drive battleships and cruisers. I was a helmsman. I was actually, title was quartermaster. I assisted the navigator and did a few things, but I didn't get much training that was you could use on the outside because there were no civilian battleships or cruisers.
Right.
Thought about going in the Merchant Marine, but that's an awful lot of separation there because you're gone around the world on those merchant ships, and I decided not to do that. The Army offered me a job being a sailor on an Army ship, and heck, that's I may as well stay in the Navy if I was going to do that.
Right.
So we started looking in the newspaper there, and we saw there were ads for kids going to school using the GI Bill, and one of the ads talked about a school in Chicago where they had, let's just call them three different majors, three different emphases.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the one I took was called Aircraft and Industrial Instrumentation, and it was a school for technicians.
What was the name of the school?
Refrigeration, and then they had other specialties. I don't remember just what they were. But that one, Aircraft Instrumentation, sounded like a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm.
So we checked into it. By golly, the school said they would accept me. And we decided, well, we can go up and go to school on the GI Bill.
What was the name of the school?
The name of the school was Industrial Training Institute.
Okay.
And it was in Chicago, Illinois. And it turned out to be a pretty good school. I went up there, after we took about a 3-month wait for the next class to begin, vacation to Utah, so she got to meet all the Utah folks and see the farm, and and she was glad she was leaving that. And we went to Chicago, and I remember we took all of our stuff. Everything we had was in a suitcase, and we bought a bus ticket in Jacksonville, Florida, and rode it to Utah. And that's a long trip in a bus.
Yes, sir.
That's the way we traveled in those days. Enjoyed it. Then we went, after our visit in Utah, we did all kind of interesting things there. But we got on the bus and went to Chicago. When we got there, the school had an apartment for us, a little one-room apartment with a private bath and a four-story building, and showed us how to ride the elevated. It was very inexpensive to ride around Chicago. It cost very, very, let's just say it almost cost pennies. It wasn't pennies, but it was not very much. The fare was low. You could go anywhere in Chicago for, I don't know, a quarter or something like that. So we started school at the Industrial Training Institute. It was just under a year of schooling. And I met a young man who was loading his car up, and he lived in the apartment building where we were moving into. And I says, are you graduating from that school? And he says, yeah, I just graduated. I'm in the graduating class. Well, what did you do? Well, he went through in refrigeration. He says, I like the school. I feel pretty good now. I'll get a good job someplace working in refrigeration. I said, that's good. He says, what are you going to do? And I told him. And he says, well, that sounds like a good one. I don't know anything about it. And I said, you know, I'm concerned because I don't have much formal education. I actually completed most of the ninth grade. And he says, well, he says, you're dealing with a bunch of GIs that are going to school. Many of these GIs were not particularly good in school. That's one of the reasons they joined the military.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason was that we had a war going.
Of course.
But what they do is when they get in this school up there, they spend their time studying rather than goofing around.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, well, I'm pretty good at the goofing around. Well, okay, that's not what you're there for. He says, I was not particularly a good student, but he says, I graduated number one in my class.
Hmm.
And I, that gives me some hope. Maybe I can get through it. So he says, sure you can, but work hard. Study every damn day. Just study, study, study. That's the secret. And I'm okay. And he says, you're going to work? And I said, yeah. What you going to do? I have no idea. What I'll do, I'll just have to find something kind of supplement my income from the GI Bill. So I went to school. First day of class, the head of the school came in and talked to us and said, okay, you're here and you're all set up now. When you came in, we had an apartment for you, and here's the schedule, and you know what you're going to do. Now, is there anyone in this group who wants a job? We all raised our hand. They said, okay, we don't have but one job today to offer you, and it's not ours, but the community knows that there are good students here and that they want to work. But I've got one job, and it's to be a pizza cook at a pizzeria, they call them in Chicago. Anybody here had experience as a pizza cook? Nobody raised their hand. Anybody want to go try this out? I said, what's a pizza cook? He says, well, it's a person that works in an Italian restaurant and cooks a particular thing called pizza. And it's usually kind of a showy thing. And in Chicago, you work out in the front window of the restaurant, and people can stand there and watch you make pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they finish, when you bring it out of the oven, they go back in and sit down and eat their pizza. And I said, I don't know how to do that. I don't even know what it is. And nobody wanted that job. And that guy said, gosh, he says, this is not a bad job. We've had a lot of students go to this place and work, and they were all satisfied. You sure none of you want the job? And I finally raised my hand, and I said, well, I need a job. but I just don't know a thing about that. I was a baker for a short time in the Navy, and they says, well, this is not like that, but you learn fast, and you'll be learning from an old master Italian a restaurant owner. And I said, well, okay. So I went out there. I took the job, and it was fun. It was not hard. He showed me here, you know, there's a few steps to making pizza. We only made three different kinds, and I learned that pizza was awfully good to eat, and I could work. I'd get off work, catch a doggone bus, or a, there's all sorts of transportation in Chicago. Go up from one side of the town to the other pretty quickly, and it was a big city, and inexpensive, and there was elevateds, and there was subways, and there was buses, and so I could get to work pretty quick, and I could work until after midnight, get home, and go to school the next day.
Right.
So I started that. I was kind of terrified, but my wife says, I'll help you. She did. She had me studying every doggone day. And when she wasn't in the telephone office working, she would go directly out to my place where I was working up in the north end of Chicago and go sit in the kitchen and talk to the people who owned the place, and we'd go home together. And she took a lot of interest in, my wife did, a lot of interest in what I was doing, and it was just another honeymoon, another good working honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a good time for the year in Chicago. I felt pretty good about the classes because I started doing fairly well on the tests. And actually, when I graduated number one in the class.
Hmm. I wonder if you might tell me about the schooling itself. What kind of curriculum, what kind of classes were you taking?
Now, say that again, please.
I'm sorry. I wonder if you might tell me about the school itself. What kind of classes were you taking? What was
the
curriculum
itself,
like?
It was an accredited school for technical training. I think that there were different schools located across the United States. I think it was probably established during the war to train technicians for the military or something like that. And then after the war, it seemed like a good thing to be doing to put, you know, I don't know, maybe one of the things was electrician, maybe one of them was welding or something. I don't know what the other specialties were. But when you came out of it, you were a working technician. You could work in your field.
Hmm.
I had to learn how to use all sorts of equipment. First of all, instrument technicians involved in a lot of smaller instruments that are used to control and monitor machines. And a watch is an example of an instrument. And so one of the things we had to do, we had to make all the tools we would use to work on something like a watch.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to make the tools that we were going to use, and we had to learn to use the equipment to make those tools. And so, for example, tweezers. We had to make a very, very fine pointed tweezer that you could use to adjust hair springs inside of a watch,
mm-hmm.
because these same kind of hair springs were found in some of these instruments. And we had to learn the theory. Why? Some are electrical instruments, some are pressure instruments, some are temperature instruments, some were all sorts of instruments like you might have in the dash in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of instruments would have a version of them in an airplane. And we also did for a lot of controls and things like that, like they would use in a steel mill to control the temperatures or the speed of conveyor belts and things like that. So they were going to automated production at that time. They had done some for some time during the war, trying to automate a lot of the production, and you needed a lot of controls, and you had to have instrument to measure what was going on, and we were involved in trying to maintain and adjust and monitor all of these kinds of instruments. So it was a pretty good school.
Hmm.
Later on, after I graduated from school, I I got a pretty good job pretty quick.
And where was this job?
Well, I graduated from the school. I would tell you how poor we were. By golly, while we were in that school in Chicago, we saved enough money to buy a car. And it was an old 1942 Plymouth. And this was 1948 or 1949 when I graduated. And we took that car, went to Florida on a vacation, went back to Utah, and drove it around up there for a short time, and it served us. So, you know, kids who didn't have much could actually get ahead if they work hard. And that taught us some really good things. One, we found we could learn, and we could save, and we could, we did a lot of things in Chicago, but we didn't spend much money.
Mm-hmm.
There was such things as the Museum of Science and Industry, and there was, we lived right near Wrigley Field. We knew that after the seventh inning, we could go over and we could go to the baseball game and watch the last two innings free. They just opened the gates to let people in the seventh inning. They did the same thing in Salt Lake, so we moved there. So, you know, you learn where things are. And there's the Chicago Art Museum, the Chicago Aquarium, and the Chicago, I can't even remember that, Soldier's Field, and there was two football teams and two baseball teams, and it was very inexpensive to live in Chicago at that time.
Yeah, great city.
So we enjoyed it. It was a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go when you finished school? What kind of job did you pick up?
As soon as we were through messing around after visiting the South where my wife was from, we went to Utah, and the next day my dad says, "You got to have a job." And I, yep. He says, "Well," he says, "I don't want you driving that old wreck of a car. You go down and get you a new car." And I said, "Dad, I don't have any money." And he said, "Well, use that one as a trade. Did you pay for it?" And I said, "Yeah, we paid for it." And he says, "Use it as your trade. You'll have a job in a few days." Well, I didn't know this was a kind of a very slow economic period in 1950. We went out and started hitting the industries in Utah. We hit Kennecott Copper, Geneva Steel. We hit lots of power plants. We hit all kind of interesting places. And they weren't hiring. Things were pretty slow. But I finally went to an electronic firm. I didn't know anything about it. And they manufactured picture television tubes. I went in there and told them I was an instrument technician, and they says, "Hey, we're hiring. We want you to come back. What are your qualifications?" I told them instrument technician. They said, "We don't need one of those. What did you do?" I says, "Well, I learned about all kind of theories concerning how instruments work and so on." They says, "Okay, we're going to consider you for our maintenance and construction crew. And you'll start at the bottom of the crew, but you'll be able to sort of pick what you want to be, an electrician or a machinist or a painter or a carpenter, or what would you like to be?" And, "Well, I don't know. Whatever you got, let me see him." So after about a month, I had a job at that company. I was hired at an advanced wage compared to the production people.
Mm-hmm.
They started me out above those, so gosh, that was nice. And the first thing they did was have me work with the plumbers, going around the cleaner, stuffed up toilets and stuff. And then the next week they had me working with the carpenter. The next week they had me painting. And the next week they had me working with electricians. And the electrician says, "Hey, we got a lot of work here to do. We're building, expanding the plant. So you can work with the electrical crew." And I got with a bunch of good young guys, and they were enthusiastic. And that's where I primarily worked. I enjoyed the work. I was learning all kind of new stuff. How do you make a picture television tube? Well, I got involved in all sorts of things they were doing to produce those things, and I worked on the equipment in that plant, and either worked on the equipment or were actually expanding the plant. So it was a learning thing for me. After a few months, we didn't have any engineers, oddly enough, in that plant. We were a subsidiary of a California company in San Bruno, California, called Itel McCullo, who made a big name for themselves during World War II, manufacturing power tubes to support radar.
Hmm.
And radar was a new thing, and they needed awfully high-powered tubes to run to power those systems. And so they decided they'd go into the TV business as well, the TV tube business, and that's just the picture tube. But that's what our plant was going to do. So we started that, and gosh, I was one of the first people employed as we got into that. So I was very early in the group, and was there, had a great time. The engineers would come up out of California and tell us, okay, we got to have a new machine do this kind of thing. The engineers have got together, designed one. We've built one that we think will do the job. You guys are going to have to implement the darn thing. So we would take that machine in the plant, and we'd try to make it do what it was supposed to do. We often found that they were deficient. They were not theoretically. They were good. They were good little engineering pieces, but they were not production qualified. You weren't able to produce stuff fast with them. So we had to modify those darn things, and this bunch of young guys with not a great deal of experience in any of our fields, some were electronic technicians and other kind of things like that, and we got together and we modified this equipment. Before long, we had that plant running, and we're producing a tremendous amount of the big television tubes, 19-inch circular tubes in 1950. So the company was booming, and the engineers come up and said, or the company said, look, we don't have engineers here. Why don't you go to school at night at the university in Salt Lake City? And I said, well, I don't think I can get in the university. I never graduated from high school. They said, well, go up and talk to them. So I did, and then that's another big long story. But so I worked there. I worked a shift for four long. I had a swing shift. My job was to keep all the equipment in the plant running, all the production equipment running during my shift. And holy smoke, there was a lot of different kind of things there, but lots of practical things. Well, you just learn fast when it's there and you get to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned out pretty good. I did have an experience trying to get in the university. They had a counselor interviewed me and said to fill out this form and come back. And so I filled out the form and went back, application for entry to the university. And there was a lady PhD counselor got me. She says, what do you want to go to college for? And I says, well, because I've got a good job at this company and they would like for me to go ahead and get some engineering training while I'm working there.
Mm-hmm.
It would help me in my job. And she says, well, you know, we have a rather prestigious university here, and we don't just let anybody off the street into our engineering degree programs. And I says, well, I would like to try. And she says, well, says you didn't finish high school. That's right. But I did go to this technical school. And she says, well, technical schools, you know, you learn how to use a welding rod or something there. And I said, yeah, I learned that, but I also learned some other things. We had a long, serious discussion, and more than one time, and she had lots of arguments why I would not be admitted And we talked and talked and talked, and finally, she said, you know, I'm going to give you a chance. We're going to let you take an examination, which we would typically give to one of our graduating students, and see how you do on that. So I took this entrance examination, they called it, and when I went back, she says, did you ever consider being a policeman?
Hmm.
Would you ever, why don't you be a highway patrolman or something like that? Well, actually, I told her I couldn't because I was too short. I wasn't big enough. You had to be big enough, and you'd do those kind of things. Fireman, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
She says, well, we really were trying not necessarily to discourage you from going to school, but what we don't want you to do is to lose your enthusiasm for working and all that kind of stuff, but you just don't have the prerequisites to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, don't you have some courses that I can take, or aren't there some high school courses that I can take or something like that to prepare myself? And she says, well, we could. Finally, she suggested that I, instead of trying to get in a four-year program, why don't you get in a two-year program? We got a special program in surveying, a special program in mechanical drawing, another one in... well, in several of those kind of engineering-related programs. You need some engineering background to work and get a two-year degree. And I thought, well, maybe that'd be all right, because you take basically the same basic courses. So they let me in as they had a term for it. Anyway, I was on probation.
Right.
They would monitor me and see what went on. So I entered the university and started taking night classes. And it looked like it'd take me 10 years to finish if I wanted to go for a four-year degree. It'd probably take me 4 or 5 years to get through a two-year program. So I started taking the basic courses and enjoyed them. They were pretty difficult, really difficult, some of them. The math, the physics, the chemistry, and biology, and some of those things were, because I had nothing, none of the prerequisites.
Right.
But I stuck with it and continued working, and things worked out pretty well.
And did you get your two-year degree there?
I'm sorry?
Did you get your two-year degree? Did you finish your degree?
Okay, now, I didn't quite hear what you said.
I'm sorry. Did you finish your degree there?
Nearly three years at the university, and I would go summer. They were in quarters, so I could go four quarters a year. And not take a full load, but take a half load or a quarter load or something like that, depending on the course and what they were offering and what I needed. And I went to work one day, and they said, okay, come on in. They met me at the gate at the plant and said, we're going to go back with you. And I said, oh, what's going on? They said, oh, come on back. So I went back. Here's my bosses. All around me. We went back in, and they says, where's your tool cart? And I had a special cart with lots of tools on it so I could move it all over the plant and work on whatever equipment needed to be worked on. And they says, okay, we're going to have to turn in all this company stuff here. And I said, what's going on? They says, well, the company just lost $2 million contracts for tubes. And we were retooling the plant to go to 24-inch tubes. And they had to redesign the plant to do it using as much mechanization as we could, because a 24-inch TV tube was so big and so heavy, and you had to handle that thing when it had temperatures about 500 degrees.
Mm.
And so you couldn't handle it with just a pair of asbestos gloves. Too heavy, and we had a lot of women working in the plant, and they had to move these tubes from one machine to another machine to another machine to do all the kind of stuff that had to be done. And so we had to fix it so we could do it mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
And they said we thought we could have the plant tooled up in a year or so, and we haven't been able to. We had these huge contracts with RCA, and RCA says we need those tubes, and we didn't have them. we were producing, but we couldn't produce at volume. And lots of little glitches and stuff you have to get worked out. I mean, it just weren't work, wasn't working. We got to let the, we're going to let two shifts go. I was on a swing shift. And they says, I said, well, are you firing me? And they said, well, you're just being discharged from the unit, from our company. You can go out and get yourself a job. In fact, we've got a company that wants you to come over and talk to them. General Electric wants you to come over and go to work for them.
Hmm.
And I said, well, I don't know. That sounds good, but I like this company. And it's, well, you know, we may get this all solved and we'll have everybody hired back in a year, but right now we've got to get the plant up to speed, and we can't do it with people producing tubes that we can't sell.
Right.
And we're not producing the quality tube yet. So there I was without a job. And I went home and talked to my wife. Hey, I lost my job today, but I got to go tomorrow to General Electric. I went over to General Electric, and they gave me a job as an electrician. And I was supposed to work on mine shuttle cars and 500 horsepower electrical motors and turbine locomotives in Salt Lake City. And of course, I knew nothing about any of those, but. You don't usually have to know much about it other than the electrical components.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work for General Electric and still went to school, and I found I would not want to work for General Electric. This company I'd worked for was absolutely fantastic, and this General Electric was a union shop, the union was more important than the worker, more important than, I thought, than the customers.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to work for a company like that.
Yeah.
So I quit. In the meantime, I talked to friends who had been at the university and had graduated. They says, why don't you consider going in the Air Force and switch your degree to something where you can graduate in a hurry, rather than sticking with this tough engineering program you're in, and have a career in the Air Force. And the one guy, I said, well, you want me to go in the Air Force? You were a prisoner of war in the Philippines. You were captured there by the Japanese. And he says, yeah, and I worked in the coal mines in Japan and all during the war. But he says, I like the Air Force, and I'm going to go back in, not as a pilot, but as a supply officer. And you got to be nuts. So we talked about it. I talked to my wife, jokingly. We checked the university and found that I could switch from the engineering program into another program where all the courses I'd taken in the engineering program would count. And I could graduate in a year and a half with my original entering class and go in the Air Force. And I had an age limit I was working with, because I thought maybe I wanted to fly. I'd never considered that before. So we put all those things together. By golly, they worked. The Air Force let me join their ROTC program. I passed the physical for pilot training. I worked for the university, and they found that I could, oh my goodness, I was in an engineering school at the university. I was in the College of Mines and Mineral Industries at the University of Utah, and I had to have 15 extra hours of credit to graduate as an engineer at Utah, or from the engineering school, over what you would if you were in the university college.
Mm-hmm.
And we got checking, and heaven's sakes, I got credit for all my old Navy time through the university. They gave me a bunch of credit for that. And I ended up with 15 hours more than I needed to graduate after a year and a half. So I graduated from the university then in a new field. My major was actually called geography, but it was in the College of Mines and Minerals, and the Air Force accepted me for pilot training, and heavens, we graduated from the university with my entering class. When I 1950, I graduated in 55, and the Air Force soon sent me orders and said, go to pilot training.
Now let me...
So things changed rather quickly in the last year and a half after all that work, working with this wonderful company. By the way, it's still there. The company is called Varian Industries today, and they're still a major producer in Salt Lake City in their specialized fields, and they're very high-level electronics, Klystrons and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good, very fine company.
Yeah.
But they, I got a good attitude working for those folks because they gave you every chance they could to do all kind of interesting things. But there, I changed from being a company man to try this Air Force thing and see if I wanted to fly.
Hmm.
So in the autumn of 1955, the Air Force ordered me to active duty to go to pilot training.
Hmm. Now let me ask you this, Dr. Maurer.
Yes, sir.
What did you know about... Because while you're here in Utah doing all of this really interesting technical work, we also have the Korean War taking place. What did you know about what was going on over there? Did you follow it closely?
Oh, I followed it. As a matter of fact, when I was in the Navy, I was looking for jobs down in Jacksonville, Florida. I had been in the regular Navy, and when I was discharged, I was completely through with the Navy. I didn't have any connection with the Navy other than I was ex-Navy. But in looking for the jobs, I found they had a reserve fleet located near Jacksonville, Florida. And somebody told me, they said, if you go out to that reserve fleet, they've got all these ships out there, and you were a quartermaster, one of the requirements for the quartermaster was you had to update all the navigational charts on the ship periodically as there are changes in the world. In the oceans and the ocean and the waterways around the world, and you have to keep all these publications up to date, and they have all these ships out there, and they have to have all these charts, these chart pools up to date. They have people doing that now because they may call all those ships back to active duty later.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that'd be all right. So I checked it, it sounded like a good deal, so I joined the Navy Reserve, and that's a forever thing almost. Then I went out to Green Cove Springs, which is not far from Jacksonville, and said, hey, I'm here, I want to work in your chart pool. And they said, the what? I said, the chart pool. I'm a quartermaster. I want to work on the charts. They said, oh, we don't have any real problem with that. We don't need anybody. And I says, well, I talked to people that are in the Navy, said, you guys do this out here. And they said, nah, we're not doing anything in that line.
Hmm.
But since you're in the reserve, you might check around later in a couple of years and see if we need anything. Ah, I need a job now. They said, sorry, we don't have anything for you. We can't put you to work. So I said, well, you guys lied to me. Yeah, we didn't lie to you. I'm telling you the truth. We don't have anything for you.
Hmm.
So I wrote the Navy an awful, blistering little letter from a ninth grade dropout and said I felt really bad that the Navy would tell me a lie and get me to join the reserve and then not have anything there for me. And they said, well, you're in the reserve. You can be in the inactive reserve and maybe someday it'll pay off for you. And I said, no, I want to get out. So they finally decided, okay, we're going to give you a discharge from the Naval Reserve. They let me out, and that was in, I have to think for a moment, I got out in 48. In 49, I had joined the reserve. By about the middle of 49, they sent me a discharge from the reserve. And not long after that, the Navy started calling back Naval Reservists for the Vietnam program. I missed the Vietnam War. I was working at going to school.
Right. The Korean War.
The Korean War. Mm-hmm. Yes. I had lots of friends. The kids my age were all, that was my age group that were in Korea.
Hmm.
I still see them in the VFW all the time. But yep. So I missed the Korean War, and I followed it very closely because I had so many friends there.
Yeah.
But we have guard units and all that kind of stuff were activated. I had lots of cousins that were my age that were in Korea. And but I never went.
Hmm.
And I didn't. Korea was over in about, the end of 53 or 54 or something like that. And I didn't get out of school until 55.
Right.
In the summer or spring of 55. So I missed the Korean War completely.
Hmm.
And I was not in the reserve.
Right.
Except for about 3 months.
Okay. Now, let's pick up the story with the Air Force at this point. You're joining a whole new service, and the Air Force hasn't been around for very long at this point.
And, no, 1947, and you're gonna, I think, is when they...
Yeah. So you're going to go into the a pilot program here. Had you ever considered flying before?
No, I had had one ride in a little airplane down in Florida. I had a cousin down there who was taking flying GI Bill, and he got so he could carry a passenger, so he took me up flying one day, and I wasn't too excited about it. I was a sailor.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the ships. I wasn't much interested in flying. Never even thought about it. But after the war, talking to all my buddies that had gone in the Air Force, in the Army Air Corps, they kind of liked the Air Force. Then this one guy who was a prisoner of war actually talked me into going into the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And he was a machinist or aircraft mechanic or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the influence there. We had a big air base in Utah. Hill Air Force Base is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of people work there. It was one of the largest industries in the state. And I was around a lot of people who were involved in aviation, but I wasn't involved personally. But I didn't know whether I was going to be able to fly or not. You know, there's some people are kind of adapted to things like this. Other people are not.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And so I was a little apprehensive. What do I do if I get into the pilot training and they wash me out? Oh, I don't want to be a ground pounder in the Air Force. I want to be... if I'm going to be in the Navy, I want to be on a ship. If I'm going to be in the Air Force, I want to fly.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little apprehensive. But in the Air Force, it didn't take long. I had some good instructors. For example, one instructor, we would go up and fly the assigned lesson for the day, and it might involve a lot of aerobatics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things they hit you with pretty hard, very early, is trying to learn to do aerobatics, because that's an extreme, and you don't have any background. It's really extreme to do all these flip-flops in the air. And so we'd go up, and we'd do the kind of thing, and you'd say, well, you did okay today. What do you think about this? I'd say, well, it's really strange when my butt is over my head. You know, it's above me, and I can see the world looking down. And he says, well, keep your mind on what you're doing. Don't worry about where the world is and all that stuff. Keep your mind on what you're doing in the airplane. And just there's some G-forces and centrifugal forces and things like that that are, and pressure and temperature and all that kind of stuff that's impacting your body. But you got to concentrate on what you're doing, but you'll do all right. So I did it. He said, okay, we got five more minutes. What do you want to do? And I said, let's do a couple more flip-flops here. That's what I call, there's a whole bunch of different aerobatic maneuvers.
Sure.
And I put them all as flip-flops. I was doing loops and Immelmanns and all that kind of stuff. After a while, I got so I enjoyed it. But it was really strange for the first few times I tried to do that stuff. And flying itself became more and more exciting. And when I finished, when I got my wings after a year in the Air Force, I was invited to stay as an instructor.
Hmm. Now, did you take this training at Hiller Air Force Base?
No, I moved around. The Air Force had a bunch of training bases. They call you in initially. You go 1 month to Lackland Air Force Base. Still, I think it's still the same program now as it was in the 50s. You go down there for 1 month of pre-flight training.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an ROTC guy like I was, they didn't feel you learned to do anything other than just march in ROTC. So you had to learn a whole bunch of things about military customs and how to march and how to act like a military person. So you get a month of that. Then they send you to what they call the primary base.
Mm-hmm.
The primary base is where they put you in a cheap little airplane, and they're not cheap a little, but they're not high-powered airplanes, but they're pretty good ones. And they teach you how to fly. Then they let you go up and fly that airplane by yourself and do a whole bunch of prescribed maneuvers and go through a bunch of academics and stuff like that to support understanding all of the how an airplane flies, the aerodynamics of it, all of the mechanics of it, and then the actual flying. It's a pretty comprehensive program. After you finish your first base, and it takes about 6 months in that first training, it's called primary, it was then, and you graduate from that, and then you go to another base where they have high-performance aircraft, and you spend about the same time, about 6 months, there learning to fly jets or something like that, and you're still a student. You don't have your wings yet. You're in what they call basic pilot training. And after 6 months there, now you're safe to get in a jet and go fly. Now you can't just go get in one of these hot new ones. You have to go through another training program to qualify for them. You have to qualify for every airplane you flew. You had
sure.
to go to another school to learn that airplane and learn all about it mechanically and electronically and all the missions it flies and stuff like that. So I finished that second program, and I was flying B-25s in that program most of the time. And in fact, all the time I was flying B-25s in that program. And then I stayed as a B-25 instructor and just had a great time. Then the Air Force decided they needed to have every pilot had to be a jet pilot. And you can always transition back to reciprocating aircraft. It's probably easier than transferring back from a reciprocating aircraft, multi-engine, to a single-engine jet.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided everybody should go to the single-engine jet program. So then they upgraded me from a B-25 instructor to a jet instructor. So I had to go get a bunch of jet time, and then I was a jet instructor the rest of my career in the Air Force.
Hmm.
So I spent my whole career flying, almost all of it flying jets, except for the first couple of years. So it was pretty exciting. I got to the point where when I was assigned to a squadron, they'd say, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to fly. Well, you can't just fly. You got to do other things too. And I said, I know, but flying is awfully important to me. Okay, so they would say, what do you want to do? And I said, well, what do you have? And so I would pick those things if I had choices. I picked those things that gave me lots of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was being an instructor in that new airplane I went to. And so I'd go through their, I've forgotten what we called up. Anyway, it's an upgrade to instructor level in that aircraft. And then I would fly not only the missions, but I would fly as an instructor for other people that were flying that airplane. And then I went out and I went to an advanced and became an advanced instructor, where I was in the top instrument flight program in the United States, where we developed all the flying techniques for instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And we taught people how to be instructors and evaluators for instrument pilots. So it was really heavy on the airplanes. And then all the time I was in the Air Force, I was also going to night school.
Hmm.
Everywhere we went, I found where the local college was and went over and started taking night courses. So I was able to do a master's degree in the Air Force when I was in Oklahoma. And later on, I did the PhD at the University of Kansas, and the Air Force paid for me to go do that.
Hmm.
And all that time I was flying. That was my primary responsibility. So I had just a wonderful career. I had a wonderful Air Force career, which involved lots of responsibility and lots of good. I spent 5 years at the Air Force Academy as a faculty member up there.
Hmm.
While I was a ground instructor for the cadets, I was also a flight instructor for the guys that were flying up there. And I flew jets and different aircraft up there.
Yeah.
So I hit it pretty hard. And the joke was, hey, they would call up the base and say, hey, you've got this mission to perform. It involves taking these VIPs from this base to this base, and you have to do it on this day. You have an aircraft and pilots that can handle this? And they'd say, yeah. So then that day would come, and come to find out it's a terrible, stormy, awful weekend. And, these VIPs would say, I don't know, can we fly in when weather's like this? Well, sure you can. We're an all-weather Air Force. Well, I know, but you've got icing conditions, and you got ice on the runways, and you got all these problems. Well, now, we don't encourage people just to go fly for fun on those days, but if a mission has to go, usually we can make it. Well, you have pilots that'll fly when it's like that? Well, we have some. And so I would get a call that say, hey, we need somebody. We had a crew set up to go to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Well, to take a VIP up there. And our other Air Force guys said, hey, the weather's too bad. We're not going to go up and fly into those kind of conditions. I mean, a guy has a right to decline because he doesn't feel that that's the kind of weather he ought to fly in.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, they'd call me at the Air Force Academy and say, hey, Maurer, can you fly tomorrow? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I can, but why? Well, we can't find anybody else that can fly this mission. Will you take it? Well, where to? Green Bay, Wisconsin. Well, yeah, they got a big storm up there. I'm saying, yeah, they got that big storm up there. You think you can handle that? Well, let me check it out. And I'd check out all the weather and stuff, and I'd say, hey, I think I can handle that, but I'm... If I decide not to go, you know, it's because the weather's it's really bad.
Right.
They said, well, if you want to take it, you got the mission. Okay, I'll take it. So I would take the mission. It would be a real bad weather situation, and I'd go to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I did that, for example, with Bart Starr.
Is that right?
Was a quarterback at the University of Alabama, was drafted by the Green Bay Packers. He won the first two Super Bowls.
Yes, sir.
With Green Bay. And so he came to the Air Force Academy to motivate our students at the Air Force Academy. And he was there about a week, and he had to go home because he had another thing he had to go to beginning the Monday. And this was a weekend. and he had to get home to see his kids. He hadn't seen them. Oh, I got to see my kids. I said, well, Bart, you know that if weather's too bad, we're not going to go. But it appears to me that it might be okay, and we can have an alternate. I might not be able to get you into Green Bay, but I can get you someplace in that general region where, if you have to, you can ride a bus all night and go home and see your kids. So he says, okay, well, we'll go. So Bart went with me. We went up there. It was really quite bad. And I told him, Bart, I'm not sure we're going to be able to land and stay on the runway. So I'm going to attempt a landing. If I find that the runways are too icy and we can't stop on the runway, we just make a touch and go out of it. We just touch down and say, oh, it's too slick to land. And then we just take off and we go to some place where we can land. And he says, that's okay, but I sure hope. And I said, well, hey, we're not going to jeopardize you or this airplane just because you have to be with your kids. I mean, that's important, but we're not going to jeopardize anybody or anything here.
Sure.
So I went up there. Yeah, it was a piece of cake. I touched down on the runway. I recognized that I did have sufficient braking and everything, and heck, we stopped, dropped him off, and so if you have a mission where nobody else wants to go, they'd call Maurer. And I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I bet so.
Lots of generals and stuff like that who were, they had to get back to Ohio, or they had to get someplace, and so they'd say, well, let's see if Maurer can get some time off and go fly with you.
Hmm.
So I appreciated that kind of thing. It wasn't reckless. You're a damn fool if you go out and kill yourself. So, you got to be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be pretty good, and you have to exercise good judgment.
Sure.
And I was fortunate enough that I was able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. That is really interesting stuff there. Now, you're with
I loved flying, and I was just—it tickled me.
Yeah.
I went down to Florida one time and picked up a general down there. He had to get back to Wright-Patterson, and we had a great big storm over Wright-Patterson. And when the general came out, I said, "General, we can take off and we'll head for Wright-Patterson. But if the weather is really bad up there, we're not going to be able to land there. The weather's is so turbulent, it'd be dangerous to try to land under those conditions." Well, I need to get back. I'm important. I'm a big wheel. You can change the weather. And I said, I can't change the weather. And we'll see what we can do. And if we can't go, I'll have to take you someplace else. Well, he finally agreed that's the thing to do. We went to Wright-Patterson. I made an approach. And that was so turbulent, this nice jet I was flying was just getting thrown all over the sky. And he says, are you going to try to land? And I said, General, I've got to get down out of all this turbulence and see whether it's too turbulent for us to land down at Wright-Patterson. But I understand there's turbulence down at the runway height as well. And he says, well, and he was concerned then, because it was awful. It's about as bad as I've ever seen it. We were just getting tossed all over the place. And so I get down about 300 feet, and it was still bumpy down there. And we're on our approach to landing at Dayton. And he says, are you going to land? And I says, General, I'm going to take it down so we're maybe 20, 30 feet above the runway, and we'll see whether or not the winds become less down there. So I went down there, and it wasn't quite as bad, so I kept going a little lower, and I got down, maybe 10 feet above the runway, and I looked at the co-pilot with me, and I says, this is terrible. We're going to have to go around. So I had my hands on the throttles, and just as I started adding power to go around and go fly someplace else, our wheels touched the runway.
Hmm.
But we hit a 10-foot drop.
Yeah.
Turbulence just dropped the airplane about 10 feet. And it dropped it so that the tires just barely got on the runway. And if you just barely touch the runway, it goes squeak, squeak. That's what we call a squeaker. Your wheels are on the runway. And we didn't bounce. And when it went squeak, squeak, well, I was just in the right spot. I could pull the power off very quickly. And we made a nice, smooth landing. And we taxied in. And when we got off the airplane, the general looked at me and he says, "How in the hell did you get that kind of a landing when it's so doggone turbulent? It's almost too turbulent to fly." Oh, I said, I didn't notice, General. That's the way I always look. Now, that isn't the truth. That isn't the truth. I was just doggone lucky that it didn't. There wasn't enough drop there that it would have. I would have damaged the gear or something.
Right.
But we didn't. It was almost a perfect landing.
Huh.
With awful, awful turbulence. So I lucked out. And I smiled and said, "Oh, that. Gee, I didn't notice it being anything different than what I usually do." So pilots have got big heads.
Right.
Hopefully you got common sense, too.
Yeah, I wonder if you might tell me about some of your other assignments. I mean, you joined the Air Force in 1955, and you don't, and of course you don't go to Vietnam until late 1967. What other things were you doing during this time? I mean, are you strictly just a...
1955, I went through pilot training. I graduated in 1956. And became an instructor pilot at the end of 1956. And I stayed at a particular base for about 3 years. I was an instructor there flying B-25s and jets. In 1959, I was going to school in my spare time at the nearby Oklahoma State University, and I got a master's degree while I was still flying those airplanes at that Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma. Then I was transferred to Waco, Texas, to a place called, what's the name of that place? Anyway, there was a nice air base Waco, Texas, and all of a sudden I can't even remember the name of the base. That shows you I'm getting old. But I went down there to be an instructor. I stayed there, and after about 2 years there, I was instructing in instruments in this instrument instructor school, and they said, "Hey, we're going to move the school and change to new airplanes. We're going to go to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, San Antonio, and you're going to be flying, we're going to have two new airplanes come into our squadron. Both of them are new, and we're going to develop instructor programs, so we're teaching the Air Force to fly a more modern stuff than we had been." So I went down there, I was one of those guys picked there, and I was just at the right time at the right place, where I got to be one of the principal instructors there, and I got to help develop a lot of the procedures we followed. I flew at Edwards Air Force Base, which is it's where they test a lot of aircraft at Edwards Air Force Base in California. And I was involved in going out there and helping to set up the procedures for this new aircraft that I was put in. And it was a wonderful airplane. I just loved it. It was called the T-39 Sabreliner.
Mm-hmm.
And we were one of the first groups in the Air Force to get it. We got a bunch of them. We got that program going. While I was at Waco, I was also going to school. I was attending Baylor University. And I was working on another master's degree there in international affairs because...
Interesting.
We were very much concerned... back in those days with Russia,
mm-hmm.
and we needed to understand Russian people, Russian culture, Russian military capabilities and all that kind of stuff. And I was learning everything I could about Russia. And I did that at the University of Utah, as a matter of fact. While I was there, we had to real experiences at Utah. But anyway, I was working on another master's degree at Baylor University, and then I went to San Antonio and flew these new airplanes there. Then, since I had a master's degree, I thought, well, you know, maybe if I go to the Air Force Academy, they'll send me out to get a PhD. Well, I tried that approach, and it didn't work. They had a lot of guys that were graduates of military academies, and they kind of get preference on a lot of that stuff, so I wasn't going to be considered, they told me. So I said, well, I'll just go up, and if they have a need, they'll try it. I went up to the Air Force Academy, and they said, oh, my golly, where have you been? We need people with your specialty right now. And so I was transferred to the Air Force Academy, and it was a, they call it the control 5-year tour. You go up there and teach for 5 years. Well, so I went to the academy in 1963. Vietnam was starting, well, it had actually started, you know, back in the 50s, but our involvement was in the 60s. And so we started having our graduates from the Air Force Academy eventually were being moved and go through Vietnam, and they'd come back and tell us about what they were doing over there. So I stayed at the Air Force Academy. I was going to school at the University of Colorado and Colorado College and Colorado Springs and Colorado Southern College, Pueblo, and taking lots of, I finally was admitted to the PhD program at the University of Colorado at Boulder as a part-time student, and that's something they hadn't done much of. And then later, after I got into that, I was the sixth person that admitted to the University of Colorado as a part-time student. I was only the third as a part-time student admitted there. And then they came back to me and said, you know, our graduate school has just thought about this, and they've decided we just can't do that. We can't give a guy a doctorate if he hasn't at least spent a whole year in residence on our campus. It just doesn't look good. People will talk down about it and say we don't have a real program.
Sure.
So they said, we're not going to let you get your PhD through our school unless you can come up here and spend a whole year in one stretch at our campus. Get the Air Force to send you up. And I said, the Air Force won't. Well, we're going to withdraw our we're going to drop you from that program. And I said, well, golly, I spend a lot of time coming up here, going to school, driving back and forth. And they said, well, you know, the Air Force, I said, the only way I can get up here is if you give me, if I earn some sort of a prestigious scholarship or fellowship at your school, the Air Force will let me accept it. And they said, we don't have any money for those things, so we can't do it. And I said, well, so I'll just do what I can someplace else. Well, they said, why don't you check with the University of Kansas? Because the University of Kansas has a tremendous amount of money for research and development programs. And they've got one in a thing called remote sensing. And I says, what's that? He says, well, that's using sensors to look at the Earth, radar, cameras, infrared, and all kind of stuff. And they're using it, they're looking at the Earth using satellites and aircraft as the platforms for these.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that sounds interesting. And they said, well, here's the guy's name, and they're the geographers down at Kansas have joined with the engineers down there, and they've got this huge program starting. Why don't you go talk to him? I went down there. By golly, Kansas says, yeah, we want you to come to our school, but we want you to start doing your part-time work with us. So they started letting me do research out of the University of Kansas, and I was doing research in Central America or in the Caribbean.
What kind of research? What did this entail?
I was doing, actually part of it was classified research on the use of radar, and Vietnam was going then.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems we had in Vietnam was that the enemy would go into a French rubber plantation and build a big nest of tunnels under that plantation, and then they would come out at night and go out and attack the South Vietnamese or the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd try to follow them in there, and the French government said, if you guys go in there and ruin our French rubber plantations, you kill any trees, you have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go in there and just bomb and raise hell with those French plantations. But the Vietnamese live under them. They says, well, that's your problem, but you can't come in there and raise hell unless you're going to pay for the plantation itself. And the United States government wasn't going to go back and do that, so we couldn't go in to those damn plantation areas. We needed some sort of an instrument we could fly over and look down and actually see where those tunnels were. And so they were doing part of that radar, trying to find out how much ground penetration do we have of radar in Puerto Rico. And another young fellow in Kansas and I had to go down there and use a bunch of classified imagery that they had collected and go out in the field and try to find tunnels if we could by looking at that imagery they had given us and see what else we could use that radar imagery. It was a special kind of radar.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing that kind of stuff in the summer times. So I was going down to Puerto Rico and places like that. They wanted me to go to Guyana in South America and work on soils problems down there from the air using remote sensing.
Hmm.
They were flying the Amazon Basin using radar at that time. And there was a lot of interest in having the Air Force become involved in its mapping the Amazon Basin, because it's always cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't fly over it with photo aircraft. Can't get pictures. Can't see it. It's clouds. And much of that is in several countries, but primarily in Brazil, but the countries around Brazil are. So there were a whole bunch of things going on down there, and so I was able to get into the University of Kansas, and they had a center for research there, and its specialty was remote sensing, and I was admitted eventually I was in Vietnam when I was admitted, but I was setting it up so I could be admitted into the remote sensing program at the University of Kansas for a PhD. That's how I did that.
That's fascinating work.
Well, you know, you got to have fun. And I was working with the Army Corps of Engineers at Wright-Patterson, and they are out of Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and we were doing a lot of stuff with them. And there's just opportunities all over the world.
Yeah.
If you start looking around and see who's doing what, and can we work with them? And I was giving professional papers at national symposia in the United States, and there were major companies from around the world that would come to these symposia to see what we were doing in the unclassified section. Now, there was also a military classified thing, and they kept me just on the periphery of that. The Air Force wasn't admitting that they were doing a lot of that kind of stuff, and they didn't want us doing very much. They were very careful about letting us become involved with it, but they wanted us to know what was going on in their areas, so incidentally we could talk about stuff, you know, in a non-classified sense.
Right.
So it was very interesting.
Yeah. And what is the time frame for all of this? When were you doing this?
I'm sorry?
When were you doing this? What is it, 63, 64, 65?
1963, I went to the Air Force Academy, and I was an instructor primarily in flying then, and taking classes
mm-hmm.
at the University of Colorado and other schools in that area.
Yeah.
In about 1966, I was working with the University of Tennessee Space Institute, writing papers for their annual symposia and some of their publications. And this was based on some remote sensing stuff that I was doing with the University of Kansas. So I was working with Ann Arbor, University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. They had a big remote sensing program. Purdue University had a big remote sensing program. UCLA had a big remote sensing program. Berkeley had a big remote sensing program. And I was going to those symposia and actually presenting papers at those kind of places. At another one would be in Boston. We were up there giving papers at an Air Force facility up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got to go around all sorts of places where people were involved in this field of remote sensing. Remote sensing was a sort of an academic term that we used in non-classified senses. It was satellite or aircraft reconnaissance when we talked about the military application.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can explain to the listener what was the state of this field, of this science, at this particular time? What kinds of equipment are you working with? How is the field of this remote sensing working at this time?
Well, one of the things I did, I had a research, I didn't have a research grant. I was a party to a research grant from my senior, my dissertation advisor at the University of Kansas. He had a huge NASA grant, which involved taking lots of pictures and reconnaissance in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
So I became involved with going down and doing all the groundwork and doing a lot of the groundwork in Puerto Rico to support the aircraft that flew. Excuse me. Then later on, after we got into this program, then I actually went, excuse me, I'm losing my voice here. Another student and I, and this other student was my assistant, we went to Puerto Rico and we flew with NASA, and the NASA aircraft were flying and collecting this data, and the NASA stuff was unclassified. So we were using unclassified radars and infrareds and all sorts of camera systems to fly over the island of Puerto Rico and other places as well, but I was only involved with NASA at the in the Puerto Rican thing. And we were down there with the aircraft flying and collecting the data in the aircraft. Later on, when I got back to Kansas, then I got a copy of all the stuff we had, and I had to analyze all this film we got in trying to show what we could see,
mm-hmm.
even when it was cloudy down there. So I conducted research on certain topics like that and presented information to NATO and to the Army Corps of Engineers and these other schools that had huge programs like the University of Michigan and Purdue and I have to think of them for a minute. Kansas was one of the key ones, and Berkeley, we worked closely with the aerial photography people out of Berkeley, and Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara, we worked with those folks. University of Tennessee had a huge Tennessee Space Institute,
mm-hmm.
which specialized in remote sensing, and I was working with them as well and doing papers for them.
Yeah. You know, that's not too bad for a ninth grade dropout.
Well, I was lucky. You know, it just, a matter of luck and being in, getting in the line, and by golly, that line goes to some places interesting, and it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dr. Maurer, why don't we stop there for today, and we can pick this up at another
time. I'm losing my voice.
Yes, sir.